Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of April. I'm so glad we're doing this show this hour. It was some time ago, I can't remember what year, that an author from the University of Iowa wrote Postville, which is a story about what Postville, Iowa was a few years ago. And we have kept up, albeit not very often, with what's been happening in that community. Because you'll recall, about a year ago, it was in May, the New York Times reported, on May 13th, actually, the biggest workplace immigration raid last year took place in Postville, Iowa. More than 300 workers were arrested, accused of being in the United States illegally or of having participated in identity theft and the fraudulent use of Social Security numbers. They were arrested at this agriprocessor's plant, a meatpacking plant, kosher meatpacking plant, country's largest producer of meat, kosher meat, which is... Well, the plant then shut temporarily, and now we have an update of what's been happening in the year since then. It's a really interesting story because, as you can imagine, a large number of immigrants changed the face of Postville, Iowa, and then with these arrests, it really changed the face of Postville, Iowa again. Our guest this hour is Marcelo Balve. He is a contributing editor for New American Media, and he has a piece that is in MotherJones.com, A Year Without a Mexican. His articles, well, he writes on immigration, national affairs in Latin America. He's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Baltimore Sun, and contributes regularly to the New York Daily News on arts and culture. He's a former AP reporter and editor in their Brazil and Caribbean bureaus. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Marcelo, thank you so much for being with us. I'm so glad you wrote this article. It's one of those stories that really is so striking when you first hear it. And the raid was so striking, and I'm so glad you've updated us on what's going on in Postville a year after those raids. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Can you, for those people who are not familiar with the Postville, Iowa story, can you tell me what Postville was like and how that community changed so dramatically when all of these people came to work at the kosher plant? Tell me what it was like maybe 3 years ago.
Sure. Well, 3 years ago, I think Postville was entering maybe what was a high water mark for Postville, because after the agri-processors kosher meat packer opened up shop in town in 1987, there was a period of adjustment that happened for the town as it began to embrace the immigrants that started working at the plant. By, say, 3 years ago, the town had found a sort of a comfortable spot in which immigrant families had really woven themselves into the texture of the town, into the schools, into the business community, into the churches. And people were starting to feel fairly comfortable with the situation. I mean, of course, there's always... you know, there's always difficulties when you have so many different groups living in one small town. But what I hear from people in Postville is that after a long period of adjustment, things were starting to feel pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And what's unusual is you've got this very, very large kosher meatpacking plant, one of the largest in the country. So you have this Hasidic community as well as this immigrant community. Talk about a mixture here, plus people who've just lived in Postville for generations.
That's right. I mean, the town had really sort of realized that, as its motto says, it became hometown to the world. When the plant first opened, they were mostly East European and Russian and some Asian immigrants that worked at the plant. Over the years, those immigrants began to drift away. And it was in the early 1990s that really Mexicans and Central Americans began arriving in town to work at this plant. This is a plant that employed some 1,000 people at its peak. This is a lot of employees for a town that's, you know, had a population that oscillated around, 2,200 people.
And then on May 12, I believe it was, of last year, what happened in Postville?
Well, on May 12th, people in Postville woke up to the sound of helicopters buzzing overhead. They woke up. Those who drove to the edge of town where the plant was would have seen a huge deployment of resources, federal agents in vans, in cars, various state and Iowa law enforcement folks around their cars with some shotguns wielded, and cordoning off the plant so that Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents could raid the plant and arrest the workers that they found inside. In just that one day, as you mentioned, nearly 400 workers were arrested. They actually had warrants for a couple hundred more workers, but it seems that a lot of those workers were in the night shift, and so many of them were never arrested. But in that one day, 400 people were arrested in an operation that, to the people in the town must have been something incredible and surreal, because when you have a few hundred federal agents storming a town of 2,000 people, you can imagine what kind of a feeling that creates in a small town.
Yeah. And I know that there were problems about being able to have people given a chance to talk about why they were there. Were a lot of people immediately sent home, Marcella?
Some people were immediately sent home that day. Not immediately. Some, spent hours and hours being processed on site. Some were sent home for humanitarian reasons. They were mostly caregivers, mostly women, and they were sent home so they could care for their children while their cases were being processed by the court system. They were sent home with ankle bracelet monitoring devices. At the high point, there were over 40 of them, mostly women again, but some men as well, who remained in town under, virtual arrest.
And then there were a number of people who were jailed, right? But as I recall this story, they were not able to. It was kind of a mess. They were jailed. People didn't know where they were. They were sending money home, and all of a sudden there was no money going home. And they were also sending money to their families in Postville, Iowa. So you had instantaneous poverty.
Yeah, basically you can see the raid May 12th as a kind of big bang that created all kinds of aftershocks that spread over Iowa and the Midwest and really to Central America and Mexico too, and the small villages where a lot of these folks are from. About 290 of the men or men and women arrested went immediately into detention, and many of them were, taken out of the town's economy immediately, and many of them served up to 4-month prison sentences before being deported. Many families just, got out of town. As soon as this happened, they really, really got frightened and saw that, this was going to be a bad situation in Postville and booked it for Chicago or other airports where they could hop on flights to go to their home country. So, you had families that were left without their breadwinners in Postville with no way to gain a living. You had families in Central America and Mexico whose, income came from these immigrants in the Midwest suddenly dried up. And you had, men and women languishing in prison because ICE's operation was pretty impressive, but it seems that the follow-up afterwards was a little more creaky than, the sort of big operation that they launched on May 12th.
You describe in your article, and you say that there's a separate question that policymakers may want to ponder. How have these raids, and they've happened in places in addition to Postville certainly, affected the communities involved?
Yeah, I think that's the question that really interested me, and I also had the opportunity. I traveled to Postville twice, in the aftermath of the raid, and I also traveled to Laurel, Mississippi, and that was the site of a raid on August 25th, which, you mentioned that Postville at the time of the raid was the largest immigration raid in modern U.S. history. The Laurel raid superseded the Postville raid after that. Almost 600 immigrants were arrested in Laurel at a transformer plant in Laurel. And what I saw in both towns and what really interested me was, how the towns themselves suffered once you removed these immigrants. It was kind of an interesting laboratory. I mean, as much as people suffered and the town suffered, you could, if you took a step away, you could see it as a laboratory to sort of observe what happens to small town economies that depended on immigrants, and who suffers when they're removed. And this, the story seemed to me to be that, well, it's not just the immigrants that suffer, it's really the whole town that suffers.
How so?
Well, in a lot of different ways. If you look at Postville, the story of farm towns in the last 20 years in the U.S. isn't necessarily a story of rising prosperity. In a lot of parts of the country, small towns like Postville were, you know, had been suffering for years and years and years. And this was the case in Postville, too. Townspeople told me that throughout the 1980s, you know, it was just one small business after another that closed up. Lots of people moved away, school districts shrinking, and what the immigrants had brought to the town is a sort of rejuvenation of the small town fabric. They had, you know, created school districts that were more robust because of the new immigrants and their families. They had created opportunities for small businesses to do better and to, you know, to open up more storefronts in the small town downtowns that, you know, had looked like ghost towns before. Lots of little things like this that might not add up to a huge impact on a state or national level, but on a small town level, sure made a big difference in people's lives.
Sure. You describe quite poignantly what's happened to so many restaurants, to places in, on Main Street in Postville, Iowa. They've just closed shop.
Yeah, I mean, now it's kind of, you know, I saw this process happen because when I arrived a few weeks after the raid, you know, these businesses were sort of limping along, stores that catered to the immigrants, restaurants that catered not just to the immigrants, but really to the whole town. There's one store called El Vaquero in Postville that I remember. And, you know, it wasn't just the immigrants that shopped there. These were stores that had all kinds of T-shirts, clothes, jeans, boots, and, you know, everybody shopped there. And El Vaquero, when I returned to Postville in early September, you know, it was completely boarded up. Other stores and restaurants also closed just a few months after the raid.
Mm-hmm. The other part of the story certainly was, well, what's happened with the meatpacking plant? Is it closed now?
It's not closed. I've been speaking with people in Postville, and what's happened with the plan is that it's in a sort of extended bankruptcy proceeding right now. They had an auction. It's sort of limping along. No one knows exactly how many people work there now. It's clearly producing at half steam, if that. What the government, what the courts are trying to do is to get someone to buy it. And they had an auction in late March, and it was apparently unsuccessful. The offers that were made on the plant were too low for the bankruptcy administrator. So it's kind of now everyone's kind of in a wait-and-see kind of posture, trying to see what happens, whether the plant will be, you know, sold to a low bidder and gutted for its usable assets, or you know, that's one possibility.
The other part of the story, certainly, that was part of the Postville book some years ago, was the working conditions for the people who were at this meatpacking plants were not the best, were they?
No, and that's an important point to bring up. It wasn't what I focused on in my article, but it's a very important point to make that in Postville, although these immigrants told me almost uniformly that they were happy to have the work, despite the conditions really were abysmal. Not only were their young teenage children, underage workers, you know, doing dangerous work in there, but, you know, women told me that they were treated badly by their supervisors. There was verbal abuse. There was at least one instance of documented physical abuse. There was a lot of sort of blackmailing of workers. You know, in terms of if you don't work or do this, you know, you're not going to work here anymore. All kinds of abuses that wouldn't happen if these workers had, you know, had the right protections.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Marcelo. Marcelo Balve is our guest, and his piece is on motherjones.com, A Year Without a Mexican, and it documents what's been happening in Postville, Iowa. It also looks at a massive sweep of immigrants in other places in the country, but the focus is on Postville, Iowa, and what happened in this tiny town when agents came by the hundreds to arrest a number of people last May. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. I recall the last time we talked about Postville, this station is heard. I'm not sure how well, but it's heard in Postville, Iowa, and we had several people call from there, which was extremely interesting. So if you're listening in Postville, call us. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls now for Marcella, and we have a full line of phone lines going. So wait a minute if you'd like to get through, and then you'll have a better chance of doing so. Teresa from Viroqua. Hi, Teresa.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, you know, hands down, Postville, Iowa was the most interesting place I have visited in the Midwest. I have a Jewish friend who is living down there, and she invited me down for the holidays a few years ago. And when we were driving into Postville, you know, it kind of looked like your typical Midwestern town with the Christmas lights and everything. But the closer you got, those Christmas lights weren't actually traditional Christmas decorations. It was menorahs, candles on the street posts. Lights. You know, it was really, really very interesting. She took us to the little Mexican grocery store, and it was just so wonderful. And here we were in this store, and there's the little Hasidic rabbis and, you know, the Hispanic people, and the culture was just so fascinating. We went to a Mexican restaurant, and then she had us to dinner at her house, and they're a very traditional Hasidic family, but we had tamales that friend of hers that she had met at the grocery store had made for us, of course, without pork, and they were kosher tamales. It was just really...
What a mixture, right? That's great.
It really was so interesting. Uh-huh. It was just really fascinating, and it's just such a sad situation what's happened out there now, and it's so unfortunate the way we have this don't see, don't tell policy with immigration and immigrants working. You know, everything was fine until it blew up, you know, but really, I think as a people, we don't have a problem with immigrants doing the work that nobody else wants to do until the light gets shined a little too brightly on it, and then everybody's outraged and incensed. And I do hope that there's some policies that get put in place to make it so these workers can do their work, hardworking, loving, wonderful people who really didn't deserve to get treated the way they did as though they were criminals. They're not. They were just sweet families, and it was a wonderful culture down there. So it's a big loss, I think. And that's my comment.
Thank you, Teresa. Thanks for your call. Marcel?
I thought that was a very, very thoughtful call. I think this is the point she makes at the end is important. I think that, you know, we have to step a little bit back here and look at the context of immigration politics in the United States. When Postville happened, of course, President George Bush was still in the White House, and immigration reform had failed in 2007. A week or two ago, President Obama announced that the White House announced that immigration reform was going to be a priority this year for the Obama White House. And, you know, it seems that stories like Postville, are going to be the arguments that people make, are going to be part of the arguments that people make of why immigration reform is important. It's not that what people say when they, you know, they talk about wanting to reform immigration, wanting to provide a path for, undocumented immigrants and people from countries like Central America and Mexico to work legally in this country, you know, they say that it's not their intention is not to create a huge labor force that will take away American jobs, but to increase the legal channels for people to be here so that they will come and do so in the light of day, so that employers won't be able to exploit them, so employers won't be able to depress wages by exploiting them, and so that this whole shadow economy and this whole bunch of places like Postville where undocumented immigrants are working for low wages and being exploited won't be able to happen as easily.
Now, there have been, you talk in the article about there was another raid that has been conducted since the Obama administration took office, right?
That's right. There was a raid that occurred in Bellingham, Washington. That raid, it was kind of interesting because after that raid happened, a lot of the critics of tough enforcement, workplace enforcement, went to the Homeland Security Department and said, well, what happened here? Obama talked very critically about these types of raids during the campaign. And Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said, well, I didn't know about that raid ahead of time. And she said we're gonna have a review of our enforcement policy. So it's kind of it seems to me that the administration is kind of walking a fine line right now. Now that they've launched their attempt to reform the immigration system, they're going to be walking a fine line between enforcement and trying to broaden support for the kind of immigration fix they want to push through.
Thank you, Teresa, so much for your call. Let's go next to Maury from Iowa. Hi, Maury.
Hi. I drive through Postville every day pretty much to go to school, and I drove past agriprocessors the day of the raid.
Oh.
And since I lived around this area my entire life, everybody knew that there were illegal immigrants working at agriprocessors and living in Postville. So it kind of was almost, you expected it sooner or later something like this was going to happen, but you didn't expect it on this kind of a scale. And the plant owners, the Rubashkin family, knew about this, and a lot of the Hasidic Jewish population didn't know this, but kind of turned a blind eye, or in some cases actually helped gather fraudulent Social Security numbers so that they could have their workers work inside the plant. I'm wondering if your person can comment on that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Maury.
Top management of agri-processors, including the former chief operating officer Shalom Rubashkin, have all been charged with various immigration-related and fraud-related charges. One agri-processor's human resources manager pled guilty yesterday to charges of exactly what the caller is talking about, turning a blind eye and knowingly accepting false ID papers from potential workers at agri-processors so that undocumented immigrants could work at the plant.
We go next to Dan from Eau Claire. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Well, first said, you mentioned it a little, but I've been in the food business for 30 years, and meat plants are god-awful places to even go to, much less work at. There has to be something done about that, and it should be done with American workers. Now, that said, I just heard what you said, Napolitano just said about her response to a raid on a plant. In Washington. What I heard, and this is from good sources in the food industry, is that they kind of covered their bets and donated to both parties this year. The thing down in Iowa, the family was a very strong Democratic family that was giving money to the Democratic Party in Iowa, and it was causing some stir there. Have you heard anything about that?
The family of
and
the plant?
Do you think Obama will go after these guys? Because I'll say it again, we could add $1 a pound to the cost of meat to fix this problem in America as far as our meat plants are concerned, and that's about what it would cost, about $1 a pound. And it's awful.
I think the caller brings up a couple of good points. I think that the point that is an important point to make. He talks about the conditions in meatpacking plants just generally. I mean, the immigrants I spoke to who work there say that not only is it dirty work, obviously slaughtering animals, cutting up animals, And not only is it, you know, a dirty atmosphere, but, you know, you're also working, a lot of the workers were working day in and day out in literally freezing temperatures. They have to keep the plants refrigerated because of the kind of products they're working with. And, you know, workers talked about, you know, their fingers going numb halfway through their shift, you know, and in the middle of winter, trudging through snow to work in a freezing plant. You can imagine what kind of work that is.
And we thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Marcelo Balve, contributing editor for New American Media, is our guest, and we're getting an update of Postville, Iowa. And we go to Jeff next, who's calling us from Postville, Iowa. Hi, Jeff.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Marcelo, you probably recognize my voice.
I'm the
GM at the local station here. Met Marcelo many times. One thing I wanted to address, the comment about Postville being a ghost town prior to the arrival of the plant. You know, all the Midwestern communities at that time were struggling. And, you know, it was a nationwide thing. So the arrival of the plant definitely was a plus. But to say that it was an extraordinary situation that we were a ghost town and not being able to survive is a little bit of a stretch. The other thing I would like to even discuss with Marcelo, if it's possible, the fact that so many different governmental agencies knew for so long what was going on here. We often hear that the residents of Postville knew what was going on. They knew there were undocumented workers here. But the Social Security Administration knew for 4 years and sent letters twice annually, letters of noncompliance, each year the numbers increasing for names not matching Social Security numbers. Now, why did the government let this go on so long?
I think those are two really good points. The first point about, you know, Postville not being a dying town before the agri-processors plant opened up in 1987. I think that's a valid point, and it goes to, you know, I think it goes to townspeople's and to the politics of Postville right now. You know, the question in Postville is, you know, that there's rumors that the Rubashkin family or people associated with the family that ran the plant want to have the plant restarted somehow in some guise or in some form. And, you know, I think that at this point in time, people in Postville are so fed up with all the negative impacts that the May 12th raid had and all the revelations about the dirty business that was going on in the plant, that they'd rather not have any dealings with that sort of enterprise again. And I think that's understandable. And I think that you know, the fact that the town can survive without it is a good point to make. And it's something that I think probably a good portion of the people at Postville, a sentiment they share. I don't know what percentage, obviously. I do think that that the question about the federal government's knowledge of what was going on in Postville and how long they let it go on is a good one as well. And one interesting point to make related to that is that according to my reporting, the U.S. Labor Department was actually conducting an investigation that was running parallel to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement U.S. Immigration Agency's investigation that resulted in the raid. And, you know, a lot of people in Postville, people that had knowledge of what was going on, you know, expressed some frustration that they didn't just let the labor investigation go on, which could have resulted in a more sort of fine-tuned crackdown in which employers might have been penalized and people arrested, but maybe, you know, not had the devastating impact that the May 12th raid had. And instead, it appears that, you know, somehow Immigration and Customs Enforcement got precedent and swooped down on the raid with their big, sort of spectacular raid on May 12th.
It was a show. It was a very, very big show. And Marcelo, as you know yourself now, if the plant does sell, and we get somebody new here in town that's going to operate a clean operation, we still have some tremendous hurdles to overcome. There is a great amount of money that's owed to the city by some of the local real estate companies. Neville Properties, the ones owned by the Rubashkin family, and GAO Investments, both major property holders here in town. Some of these homes were purchased at inflated prices, and people coming in here, even if it does open up again, are going to be faced with rents that are astronomical for this area. The water treatment plant and the payments that the plant is supposed to make on that to the city to keep that going, all of these things are working together to make a downward spiral that, even if it does open up, we have tremendous difficulties. So, you know, all the effects from the raid and the people being gone, the people not paying city revenues, all of this is continuing to grow day by day, and it's almost insurmountable.
Well, and I mean, I imagine that with the overall economic crisis the country is going through, it's kind of even more of a perfect storm.
Yes. Tell me a little bit more about KPVL, Jeff. What kind of radio?
We're a local community radio station. We are a member of NPR and Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We do a Roots in Americana format. It's interesting because when I got here, it was prior to the raid, and all of my years in public radio were spent in programming and production and hosting. I had never been involved with the news. And suddenly on May 12th, I found myself in the midst of a situation that was overwhelming for anybody with years of experience in the news.
And I'm sure people were calling on you from all over the world to talk about what was going on in Postville, Iowa, right?
It was that way. After the raid itself, excuse me, when the company was going through trying to get the place staffed again, there were so many different groups and factions of people coming in here. They had labor supply companies that were recruiting out of homeless shelters in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
People coming up here with dependency problems, and they had been participating in programs down there for various social troubles or whatever you want to call them. And they get up here, and we're 100 miles away from anything that can provide support like that. So we had people coming in here that needed help that way. We had people coming in that couldn't afford to buy food because the rent payments were being taken out of their check. One of the companies that was supplying labor here would lease the houses from one of the local real estate holders for anywhere between $600 and $700 a month, and then turn around and put 10 to 12 people in that very same house and charge them $125 to $175 a week, which would almost quintuple the value of the rent for that house.
Right.
And they were getting nothing on their paychecks for sometimes 3-4 weeks. And just an amazing thing.
Thank you so much for listening and calling in, Jeff.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Many levels to this story, aren't there, Marcella?
Yeah, and, you know, Jeff really has his finger on the pulse.
Right.
One interesting thing, it goes back to another point another caller made, is that Jeff was talking about a lot of the recruitment that went on as agri-processors sort of raced to try to replace the workers that had been arrested. You know, they trawled so far and wide for workers that some of the workers that were brought in from the South Pacific, Palauans from Micronesia, which is a U.S. protectorate, so they can work here legally, they were brought in. Somalians from Minnesota were brought in. They can work here legally because they have refugee status. There are people, as Jeff mentioned, brought in from Texas, from border cities in Texas, from all over the Midwest. So, you know, in September when I arrived in Postville, the atmosphere was perhaps even more cosmopolitan than it had been before the raid, because you had Somalians, you had Palauans, you still had Mexicans and Central Americans, you still had some Ukrainians that were around from the first round of immigrants that came to work at agri-processors. So, you know, when all is said and done, maybe some of those folks will stick around too, and Postville will be able to keep its motto as hometown to the world.
Right. Oh. Thanks, Jeff, so much for your call. Let's go to Steve from Rice Lake. Hi, Steve.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I just have to say I can't believe that the people of Postville just don't hang their heads in utter shame that they were willing to accept such exploitation of people and profit from them, and now be upset that they can no longer exploit them, people, and profit from them. I just think the folks of Postville should should have a day of mourning for themselves for being just so selfish. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you for the call, Marcel.
I understand why the caller, not being inside of the story might have that idea. I think if you visited Postville, you would realize that, you know, the people in Postville who realized what was going on in the plant in terms of how the plant was managed, there was a lot of worry, concern, even anguish, I would say, about how that plant was being managed. And, obviously, some people in Postville were closer than others to the management of the plant. But I would venture to say that it's really an injustice to sort of take a broad brushstroke and say that all of Postville should hang their heads in shame. There was a lot of struggle back and forth with the management of the plant over how it was run, what kind of operation it should and shouldn't be. And, we have to remember, too, that Postville, as much as I think that Jeff made the point that it's not that it's necessarily going to die without the plant. It was kind of a company town. Agri, as they call it there, was the lifeblood of the town. And, there's a lot of give and take. But to say that, Postville townspeople were sort of sitting pretty and, profiting from what was going on in the plant is kind of a stretch.
Thank you, Steve, for your call. We go next to Brian from Green Bay. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I was just calling to bring up the point about if you compare wages in meatpacking plants from the late 60s and early 70s to today, you'll see that those wages have gone down in terms of actual buying power, pretty dramatically, in fact. IBP started that and sometime in the 70s. Aggressively recruiting illegal immigrants and refugees who are here legally. The conditions that we have in the meatpacking plants now are approaching what we had when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle in 1905 or 6. If wages had kept pace, there wouldn't be a problem with filling those jobs with people who were not illegal immigrants, and there wouldn't be that draw. The only people that really make, that do well out of this, even the immigrants, they get used up. As soon as they're injured badly enough they can't work anymore, they're thrown away. The only ones that really make it are the ones that own the plants and the shareholders, who most of whom probably don't even know what's going on.
Marcel?
I think that's a really good call, and I think that goes back to my point about the immigration system that we have. It seems to me that if you created broader channels for special workers, guest workers, workers for selected industries, such as the food industry and the meatpacking industry, if you created broader channels for immigrants to be able to come in and work in those industries, I think it would, remove this huge shadow population of 12 million undocumented immigrants that we have, or at least reduce it. And my hunch is that it would raise wages and improve working conditions in these industries. I think that the caller is right that, the meatpacking industry's reliance on immigrant labor and the hidden secret that we saw in Postville of and other meatpacking plants in the Midwest earlier in this decade, they had raids as well. The hidden secret of relying on immigrant labor has acted as a drag on wages and labor conditions.
Thanks for the call. We have an email that's come in from Karen. I've heard someone say that the schools were really deeply affected by the raid. Please discuss this.
I heard the same. I heard that a lot of school districts in the region had not necessarily suffered the danger of closing or anything like that, but that schools had consolidated, that enrollment had shrunk in a lot of areas and towns like Postville, and that once immigrants started arriving into the town, the schools had a bit of a renaissance. There were bilingual programs in place at Postville. Since the raid, the enrollment has gone down. Apparently, it hasn't dropped dramatically because, remember, the plant has you know, made these sort of gargantuan efforts to trawl for replacement workers, although there seems to be a little bit of a revolving door going on. But yeah, enrollment has dropped in Postville, as the information I have.
And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Marcelo Balve is our guest. His piece and update on what's happened in Postville, Iowa, is in MotherJones.com, A Year Without a Mexican. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Randy is next from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Randy.
Hello. How are you today?
All right. How are you?
Wonderful.
Good.
I used to work for an egg processing plant in Alden, Iowa, and we were raided by the name slips me now.
Immigration. Mm-hmm.
And we went from 42 employees to 6.
Ooh.
And in a day, and basically everybody that was left in the plant worked unbelievable hours, and we trained the local people that applied for the jobs, and approximately 4 months later, one of the owners of the company approached me and asked me what I thought about bringing the same group of people back to work in the plant again, and I asked him how he was going to do that, and he says, well, he says, they'll have the correct paperwork when they come back. And I feel sorry for the workers that were deported and how their lives were disrupted. And the owners of this particular company had absolutely no regard for these people whatsoever other than cheap labor and a way to manipulate them to work extraordinary hours. And I was wondering what the guests thought about that.
When was this, Randy?
In Alden, Iowa?
No, when? What year?
Would have been 1991.
Mm.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that this is kind of an ongoing thing. That there were Swift meatpacking plants in late 2006 raided all over the Midwest, and something like over 1,000 workers were arrested and all in those raids. And you know, I think the caller's point goes to the question of, can these plants survive without foreign labor, without immigrant labor? And, you know, I'd like to speak on that just, you know, in what I saw in Postville and in Laurel, Mississippi, is that the plants do make an effort to recruit citizen workers once they're raided by immigration authorities. But what seems to happen, what happened in Laurel and Postville, is that they get workers, but the workers will work for 3 weeks, a month maybe, or maybe not even that, and then they go, and they have to get replaced again. And they do this because a citizen worker, at the wages they're offering in those industries, has other options. I interviewed people in Laurel, Mississippi at the local mall who had worked at the same factory where all the immigrants had been arrested, and they said, you know, I'd rather work at this tennis shoe store making a little bit less money or comparable money than working those awful conditions at the plant and doing really back-breaking work. For the people in that town, it was kind of work that they would do when, you know, when hard-pressed, but that they would rather really not do. So, you know, it's not just a question of getting workers and bodies into the factory. It's about keeping them there month after month, year after year, and that's a real challenge unless you have workers that are incentivized enough to stay there like these Mexican and Central American workers were.
Thanks, Randy, for your call. Carla is next from Onalaska. Hi, Carla.
Hi. I had some contact with the church workers that were trying to help with the aftermath last summer, and I just first wanted to say how embarrassed I was of our government that was willing to plan very thoroughly to go in and round people up and take them away, but had no apparent plan for how they were going to help the town afterwards. And the story that I wanted to ask a question about that I was just most upset about had to do with the children. And the church workers there were telling me stories of how the parents were either sent to jail for having these for identity theft because of the social security numbers, or they were deported immediately. But the children who were born here then were, couldn't go back with their parents, and so they were left to us. And aside from how horrible that is to make these children orphans, it seems like a terrible stress on our system to create all these orphans for us to take care of after. And I wondered if your guests had heard anything about the children.
Those are all very good points. I think that that's the general sentiment of the, you know, the people at St. Bridget's Church in Postville, for example, that really spearheaded, along with the Lutheran Church there, the relief efforts in Postville. And, you know, the St. Bridget's was kind of like the sanctuary for immigrants in Postville in the aftermath of this raid. You know, their point is we understand that the federal government did this. What we don't understand is why they would do this and not make any provisions for taking care of people and emergency services for these people in the aftermath of the raid. They felt like they were left holding the ball and spending literally hundreds of thousands of dollars feeding families, caring for families, providing legal, psychological, what have you, support to these families, and the federal government just came in, did what they did, and abandoned them. The point about the children is a real big part of the story. I wrote for New American Media a story that has to do just with this question about the effects on children. Not only were a lot of teenagers working at the plant, but a lot of kids were left either without a mother or a father or both in the aftermath of the raid. It was, you know, really heartbreaking. Especially the first time I was in Postville, to see what kind of situations this left children in and parents in. I remember visiting one man in a trailer, just right by the factory. He had something like six children, and his wife had been arrested in the raid, but she was so afraid of, you know, creating problems for her husband or her children, since they were all undocumented, at least the ones that hadn't been born in the United States, that she didn't tell them that she had children to take care of. And so she remained in prison, and her husband was left trying to work or cobble some sort of livelihood together while caring for six children at the same time. And, you know, I visited them at their home, and, you know, the look of, you know, fear and anxiety on these children and the just complete exhaustion in the face of the father was really something really sad to see.
Well, this once again points to the fact that we need some kind of policy here that works for the American economy, that's humanitarian. This just goes on and on and on, and we don't really address the problem, do we, Marcelo?
No, I mean, the root cause of this problem, at least in terms of what the United States can do, is immigration policy in general. My feeling is that it creates a huge bottleneck. There are so many people in Mexico that would like the opportunity to work in our economy. There's a great need for this kind of labor in our economy, in certain parts of it, at least. And, you know, this pent-up demand to come here is what leads to illegal immigration. You know, 12 million people in some states, it's, you know, 25% of the population in California, by some estimates. So, you know, you really, of the immigrant population, so you really have to, I think, broaden the legal channels through which people can come here. People think that it's easy to come, you know, get in line in Mexico at the U.S. Embassy and get your permit to come work here, and that's not the case at all. It's not simple. It's not straightforward. And, you know, I think that the result is the situation that we have in this country that, to me, seems untenable.
Right. And it's very dangerous. Okay, thanks for the call. Stephanie from Madison, hi.
Hi there. First of all, I promised your call screener I'd be very careful and very delicate about how I say this. And I'm saying this, I think, really with compassion and understanding of the human condition in my heart. And it's what makes me sad, in a way, is that the family who owned this plant, the Jews have been so treated so unfairly and so tormented through, you know, centuries. I don't want to point fingers. But it's a strange thing in the human condition. Maybe we pass along our misery in some way or another. You know, you'd think that there would be a little more empathy. And I know that I think the Jewish community is talking about this, you know, having kosher food presented produced in an ethical manner. You're having ethics involved in the production of the food. It's so sad. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to, I want to be careful in how I articulate it because I don't want to be, it's not right to judge, you know.
No, I think you've done it well, and there was a huge uproar in the Jewish community about this, wasn't there?
Sure, not just in the liberal Jewish community, but in the conservative Jewish community as well. You know, those some of the most active responses to what happened in Postville and the aftermath came from Jewish groups, some of which visited Postville. As the caller said, a huge debate was begun about adding, workplace conditions and the ethics of production to kosher certifications. That debate is still going on, and it was a big part of the story.
And thank you, Stephanie, for the call. Profoundly interesting story. Thank you, Marcelo, so much for doing the article.
Oh, thank you so much.
Marcelo Balve, contributing editor for New American Media, A Year Without a Mexican. It's in the Friday, March 20th online, motherjones.com. And we thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production. And thanks for all of your, every time we've done this subject, we just get these profoundly interesting calls. So it's nice to have people listening in and around Postville, Iowa to add to the discussion. All right, that's it for today. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.